from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We are not thugs, we are not selfish, we are not greedy. We are hardworking New Yorkers, dignified men and women who are putting decades of service to keep the city moving.
Roger Toussaint, president of the Transport Workers Union Local 100. He goes to jail today, a 10-day sentence for authorizing a December strike that shut down New York's transit system. He will join us in our Firehouse studio. Then New Orleans holds its first mayoral election since Hurricane Katrina. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has approved plans to greatly expand the use of elite special operations forces to secretly take part in missions outside of war zones as part of the so-called war on terror. According to the Washington Post, the Pentagon has already dispatched teams of Army Green Berets and other special operations troops to U.S. embassies in about 20 countries in the Middle East, Asia, Africa, and Latin America. The secret forces are instructed to carry out clandestine military activities, including hunting down wanted individuals, gathering intelligence, attacking sites believed to be terrorist training camps, and partnering with foreign militaries. The secret operations will be run off the books and largely free from congressional oversight and legal restrictions imposed on the CIA. In Nepal, opposition groups are calling for a major protest in Kathmandu on Tuesday, outside the gates of King Dhanendra's palaces. A half million people are expected to participate in what would be the country's largest pro-democracy rally to date. Earlier today, the government imposed a daytime curfew for a fifth day in the capital city. Police were ordered to shoot anyone violating the curfew. On Saturday, up to 300,000 people marched within a mile of the King's Palace before police beat them back. A British tourist named Ian Chalmers said the police attacked a peaceful protest.
We were in what we thought was a very peaceful protest. Towards the back of that, all of a sudden, tear gas came flying in. And there's a stampede of people, chaos, absolute pandemonium, where everybody runs all over the place. We tried to get to the side on the basis that we weren't going to get baton charged, but just the stream of people trying to get out, but everyone seemed cornered as more and more tear gas sort of rained down on us. And then as we managed to sort of get away, we saw a couple of bodies just lying limp on the floor. And
on Sunday, thousands defied a daytime curfew to hold more protests, but police opened fire on the demonstrators with rubber bullets, tear gas, and live ammunition. At least 27 people were injured. Since the general strike began on April 6th in Nepal, police have killed at least 14 people and injured hundreds more. On Friday, the opposition groups rejected an offer by the Nepali king to select a prime minister of their choosing. The CIA's former top official in Europe has revealed President Bush ignored intelligence that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction. The official, Tyler Drumheller, said former CIA Director George Tenet personally told Bush and Vice President Cheney that Iraq's foreign minister had admitted to U.S. spies that Iraq had no WMD program. Drumheller said the information was ignored. He told 60 Minutes, quote, the policy was set. The war in Iraq was coming, and they were looking for intelligence to fit into the policy. In Britain, the Sunday Herald of Glasgow reports Foreign Office lawyers have formally advised Tony Blair's government that it would be illegal under international law for Britain to support any U.S.-led military action against Iran. In the run-up to the Iraq invasion in 2003, Foreign Minister Jack Straw received similar private advice, but it was largely ignored. New government statistics show the number of terrorist attacks worldwide nearly tripled over the last year, topping 10,000 for the first time ever. Experts said the number jumped because of the expanding war in Iraq and a broader definition of what constitutes a terrorist attack. In Baghdad today, six car bombs exploded in the Iraqi capital, killing at least eight people, including a 10-year-old boy. Over 80 people were wounded in the blast. On Sunday, at least three U.S. soldiers and 31 Iraqis were killed. Meanwhile, Shiite leader Jawad al-Maliki has been tapped to become Iraq's next prime minister, replacing Ibrahim al-Jafri. According to the Los Angeles Times, in terms of ideology and personal history, Maliki and Jafri appear to be carbon copies. They're both devout Shiites from the holy city of Karbala who lived in exile after Saddam Hussein came to power. They both served as spokespeople for the Dawah Party, which was once considered a radical group that claimed responsibility for bombings and assassinations against Hussein's government. The White House believes a new audio message from Osama bin Laden that aired on Al Jazeera is authentic.
ومما يظهر ذلك أيضا رفضهم لحركة حماس.
In the recording, Osama bin Laden accuses Western countries of carrying out a crusade against Islam in Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, Chechnya, Somalia, and Pakistan. He calls on supporters to travel to the Darfur region of Sudan to fight peacekeepers who he accused of stealing the region's oil. Bin Laden also criticizes Western nations for cutting off funds to the Hamas-led Palestinian government. Both the Palestinian and Sudanese government distance themselves from bin Laden's comments. The Central Intelligence Agency has fired a longtime officer named Mary McCarthy. The CIA accused her of leaking classified information to the press about how the agency is running secret overseas prisons in several foreign countries, including two in Eastern Europe. McCarthy had worked at the CIA for over two decades, most recently in the Inspector General's office, where she investigated allegations of CIA-backed torture inside Iraqi prisons. Former State Department counterterrorism expert Larry Johnson said, quote, "I'm struck by the irony that Mary McCarthy may have been fired for blowing the whistle and ensuring the truth about an abuse was told to the American people." Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been accused of leaking highly classified military intelligence on Iran to a pro-Israel lobbyist in the same manner that landed a lower-level Pentagon official a 12-year prison sentence. The allegations surfaced on Friday in the case of two former lobbyists from AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. The lobbyists are charged with receiving and disclosing national defense information. Lawyers for the men asked a federal judge to subpoena Rice to testify in order to show that top Bush administration officials approved of disclosing sensitive information to the defendants and that the leaks may have been authorized. In military news, the Pentagon has revealed 83 soldiers in the Army and National Guard committed suicide last year. It marks the highest total since 1993. In New Orleans, Mayor Ray Nagin has survived the first round of the city's mayoral election. Nagin won 38% of the vote. Louisiana's Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu came in second with 29%. The two will now face each other in a runoff on May 20th. Landrieu is the son of Moon Landrieu, the last white mayor of New Orleans. Nagin's the first incumbent to face a mayoral runoff in almost 25 years in New Orleans. We'll have more on the election after headlines. In California, over 1,000 protesters greeted President Bush on Friday during his visit to Stanford University. Protesters blocked the only street to the site of the president's meeting at the Hoover Institution. This forced the White House to move a planned meeting to the residence of former Secretary of State and Hoover fellow George Shultz on the outskirts of the campus. Over 100 police dressed in riot gear attempted to clear the street. Three students were arrested for blocking the road. On Saturday, another 2,000 protesters lined the streets of Sacramento, where the president gave an Earth Day speech on fuel cell technology. 500 protesters also gathered in San Jose, where Bush met with California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and high-tech leaders at Cisco Systems. In Vermont, over one-third of the state's legislators have signed a letter calling on Congress to consider impeaching President Bush. The letter was signed by 56 members of the House in Vermont and 13 members of the state Senate. A standoff between Mohawks from Six Nations territory in Ontario has entered its 56th day. On Thursday, Canadian police arrested 16 people in a pre-dawn raid. Over the weekend, the Mohawks decided to maintain a blockade of a local highway and to keep occupying land that's being developed into a new housing subdivision. The Six Nations Confederacy has been called the oldest living participatory democracy on Earth. In Louisville, Kentucky, civil rights activists from around the country gathered to pay tribute to Ann Braden, who died last month at the age of 81. Braden was one of the leading white civil rights pioneers in the South. In 1954, she and her husband made national headlines when they bought a home in an all-white neighborhood and signed it over to an African-American family. The Bradens were charged with sedition. The house was firebombed. Anne's daughter, Beth Braden, said her mother was dedicated to fighting three things: racism, poverty, and war. Speakers at Sunday's memorial included Angela Davis, Bernice Johnson Reagan of the musical group Sweet Honey and the Rock. Sweet Honey and the Rock here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers around the country.
So, Juan, you're going to be on Lou Dobbs tonight on CNN?
Yeah, his producers called me last week and asked me to come on and to do a round table around the immigration debate. Obviously, it's beginning to heat up again, or will heat up in Congress this week.
Lou Dobbs has, to say the least, taken a fierce anti-immigrant stance, the kind of campaign he's been on for several years.
Yeah, he's actually, I think, conducting the longest-running series ever known on television now. Broken Borders has been playing now for close to 3 years, and I think it's had more impact on some of these right-wing legislation than just about anything else on television.
So has it been a negotiation you're coming on?
Well, we had quite a bit of discussion beforehand about what the subject matter would be, and my concern about his show. And he knows about it because I've talked with him previously about the concern that when I had as president of NAHJ about the kind of coverage that he was providing. And I'm also well aware that within CNN, the employees of CNN have banded together and a couple of years ago complained about the biased coverage of Dobbs. But the only thing that the management did was to change the title for the show from a news program to a commentary program. But most listeners don't know that. Most viewers don't know that.
So in your negotiation, will you be able to speak?
Well, that remains to be seen. But I made it clear that I was not into a Chris Matthews or O'Reilly shouting match. If you wanted to have a reasoned discussion about the issue of immigration, I'd be more than glad to accommodate him. We'll see what happens.
Well, I look forward to watching it.
Well, meanwhile, on Saturday, New Orleans held its first election after the Hurricane Katrina disaster. Mayor Ray Nagin and Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu won the two top spots and will face each other in a runoff in May. The race pitted 22 candidates against each other and brought national scrutiny on the shifting racial dynamics of the city. Because many African Americans still have not been able to return to New Orleans, the city faces the possibility of a white mayor for the first time in almost 30 years. The last white mayor was Lieutenant Governor Landrieu's father, Moon Landrieu, who left office in 1978.
36% of the city's 297,000 eligible voters participated in the election. Mayor Nagin got 38% of the vote, Landrieu 29%. According to an analysis of demographic data by GCR and Associates, Nagin received 65% or more of the vote in predominantly black neighborhoods. This is almost a complete reversal from 4 years ago when he received most of his support from white voters. More than 20,000 voters cast ballots early by mail, fax, or at satellite voting stations around the state. Displaced citizens were not allowed to vote by satellite if they were staying outside Louisiana. Here to talk more about the election in New Orleans is Ted Shaw, the director, counsel, and president of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Welcome to Democracy Now, Ted Shaw.
Thank you, Ian.
It's good to have you with us. Your assessment of this election?
Well, we at the Legal Defense Fund, and we've been working in concert with a constellation of civil and human rights organizations. We have mixed feelings about the election. We have mixed feelings because there are still a lot of people who are eligible to vote, who wanted to vote, who were unable to vote because the state and the federal court did not go as far as we thought they should have gone in ordering some of the extraordinary measures necessary to make sure that the extraordinary conditions created by Katrina were ameliorated. So, for example, we wanted out-of-state polling places. We didn't get that. We got in-state polling places, but a lot of people were still confused about that. They thought they could show up on election day and vote in some of the satellite polling places outside of New Orleans. Those, in fact, were only eligible or available for early voters, and that ended before Saturday, of course. But having said that, there were thousands of people who probably wouldn't have been able to vote but for the efforts of these civil and human rights organizations and activists to get the state to take on some of the measures they did take on. There were people who were bussed in from Atlanta and people who came from Houston, from all over Louisiana to vote. There were people who really, for them, this was their way of saying that we are still New Orleanians and we have a stake in the city and we want to return. The organizations like the Legal Defense Fund that worked on this are very clear that their interests were nonpartisan interests, and so our interests were in just making sure that as many people were eligible to vote as possible. Ordinarily in a New Orleans election, you don't have extraordinarily high voter turnout anyway. 140,000 people would be commonplace. And here, it's estimated so far, though I think we have to wait for the numbers to come in more clearly. It's estimated that there were about 108,000 people who may have voted. But that leaves about 30,000 people, 32,000 people lower than the ordinary turnout.
So they're saying about a little over a third of the people voted.
Well, that's right. But also, I think that the difference between the ordinary turnout and the turnout here really isn't the measure, because I think many more people wanted to vote in this extraordinary circumstances. People were more electrified about exercising that right. So there's, as you know, the runoff election on May 20th, and our concern now is to make sure that people still get the information they need, that some of the things that could have been done better, both with respect to the mega sites where there were long lines of people and some confusion.
But that's one of the things I wanted to ask you, whether what's your sense of the process itself, especially heavy challenges to voters, or were they much more lenient in terms of the challenge situation? What were the lines like? In other words, the mechanism of the process itself.
Well, it varied from polling place to polling place. There were some of the polling places that I just mentioned were larger than others, and there you had longer lines, some confusion. But we don't have any report so far of really malfeasance going on. I think more we were concerned about and are concerned about the confusion and the failure of the state to take on some of the other measures that could have been taken on. On Election Day itself, there were a lot of people monitoring these elections, and so far we are unaware of any issues that would give rise to concerns about malfeasance.
When Reverend Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, other activists had a big rally in New Orleans, they were saying, here, Iraqis can vote for the elections. The U.S. makes sure to prove the legitimacy of the elections in Iraq, that Iraqis here could vote has set up satellite voting. And yet here in this country, they couldn't set up satellite voting outside of Louisiana for New Orleans, for perhaps the most important mayoral race in the history of New Orleans, because it'll determine the future of this decimated city.
Well, that's right. And I was down there for that march and have been down there a number of times. And we actually litigated that issue before the federal court before the march and made that same point with the federal judge. And the federal judge, Ivan Lamel, did not conclude that he had the ability or the inclination to order out-of-state polling places.
What was his argument?
Well, his argument was, as an African-American who grew up in New Orleans, he believed that he was going to do what he needed to vote, and he thought that people needed to do it, period. Come back to New Orleans to vote. But also, I think he did not see legal authority to order out-of-state polling places. Our view was that, look, this is an extraordinary circumstance. Put some pressure on the federal government and on the state to do it. It doesn't take a whole lot of money or effort to actually set up a polling place itself. And it could have been done in places like Houston and Atlanta, where there are large numbers of people who have been displaced. And the point that you just referred to is a powerful one that we've all been drilling on, which is that if we could have out-of-nation polling places for Iraqis living in the United States, we certainly should have had it for people displaced by Katrina. Living within the United States, democracy should begin at home.
We're talking to Ted Shaw, Director, Counsel, and President of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. We're going to go to break, and we come back. We're also going to go to a FEMA-run trailer camp in Baton Rouge that we tried to speak to some of the residents in just earlier this month. And we're, you could say, ridden out of town. Stay with us by the authorities in charge.
Election day is coming, so cast your vote. Election day is coming, so cast your vote. Yeah. Right here in America. Don't be afraid, no.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Ted Shaw, head of the NAACP Legal and Defense Fund. Juan?
Ted, I'd like to ask you, I know you're a nonpartisan group and you don't take sides in any kind of political issues, but I'm just interested in your take on this change of support for Ray Nagin, because some of the articles I've seen are making it seem that this is basically a racial battle, when it seems to me that there could be real concern among the voters of New Orleans about how Nagin performed in the situation in which he was under. And I'm especially concerned about this shifting of the vote from a largely white support that he got last time to largely African-American support this time. Any thoughts about what might be happening there?
Well, of course, there are a lot of thoughts about what's happening there. Look, we've been, meaning the Legal Defense Fund, we've been in Louisiana for a long time litigating cases. We litigated the case that produced the congressional district that elected the only African-American in Congress from Louisiana right now, Bill Jefferson. Racially polarized voting has been around in New Orleans for a long time. Nagin was a candidate of the white business community. He made the statements about Chocolate City. He's lost a lot of white support, but New Orleans is being remade in the eyes of some as a kind of white city that is Disneyfied, in which black folks have been displaced, except those who are going to be there to be the cultural attraction for New Orleans. We believe that everybody should have the right to vote, the right to return, no matter if they're black or poor, rich or white, etc. And the voters should sort all this out. Racially polarized voting is a long, old reality in New Orleans. We want everybody to have the right to vote. Let them sort all that out.
Ted Shaw, thank you for being with us. The mayoral runoff race will be May 20th. We're going to continue now to look at New Orleans and the problems facing citizens who were displaced by Hurricane Katrina. Earlier this month, Democracy Now! Went down to Louisiana. We had a chance to take a rare look inside Renaissance Village, a trailer park on the outskirts of Baton Rouge that houses more than close to 2,000 Katrina evacuees. The trailer park's been described in Louisiana press as, quote, FEMA's dirty little secret, in part because of FEMA's tight control over who has access to the park. Prior to being kicked out of the trailer park by the private security guards in charge, we managed to speak to Donna Aziz, who lives at the trailer park.
A good bit of my things got flooded. My car got flooded. My refrigerator was gone. And I had a shed in the back with my washing machine and dryer and a lot of other stuff. All that got destroyed. Mm.
So how did you end up here?
Well, my brother, it was like 13 of us in a van. And we all came in my brother's van, and he brought us up here.
So did you end up first at the shelter and then here?
Yes.
And what's the trailer park like?
It's horrible. It smells bad out here. You smell a sewer. It's horrible living out here. You got to deal with all the bugs, caterpillars coming all up on the porch, going up in your house. And some of the trailers, like the trailer I'm living in right now, is very small. And it's hard to keep clean. It's me and my baby in there, and it's very hard to keep it up. And it's a lot of wear and tear on your mind.
Where do you get your food?
Well, I buy my food. We had a cafeteria over here, but they just closed it April the 6th.
Why?
They said enough people wasn't going to eat it, but the food was horrible. Only had a couple of things that taste good. The fish and the chicken, everything else was like slop.
So where do you get the money to buy the food?
Well, I get food stamps. But everything here is so high, you just got to really be wise in spending it, because the cost of living is very expensive.
Mm-hmm. And what about propane?
Oh, I have to buy my own propane.
Did you always have to buy it?
No, FEMA was supplying it, and they told everybody you could stay here and propane, I believe, for 18 months, and then now we have to start paying for it.
Have you been here for 18 months?
No. But it's a program going on now. They're trying to really get you out. We've just been here maybe about 6 months, but they said 18 months. But they're not agreeing to what they said.
Can you go back?
Home? I could go back home, but I think it just might be... I'd rather stay here in Baker, but I think it's just even worse over there because everything is jumped up. The rent, everything. Everything is very, very high. Higher, probably higher than here in Baker.
Could you go back into your house?
My house, I could go back, but I'm really sure my landlord probably have triple, because it didn't get flooded. A lot of houses on my block. But what saved my house was that it was up high up on steps. That's the only thing that saved it. But mostly everybody else, their houses were destroyed.
So you could go back into your house?
I could go back. But I couldn't afford it. The rent is too high. I couldn't afford it.
But how do you know that the landlord increased the rent?
Because it's everywhere. You know, everywhere you go, the rent has increased. Everything has increased. And then I heard that the government was going to help you out, but that's just for a certain period of time. And then after that, you're on your own. So even if I stay here, I have to find a house that I can afford, because they're only going to give you a certain amount of money to help you for a while. And then if you can't afford that high rent, well, then you're out the door.
Are there rules here that you have?
Yeah, we have the FEMA park rules. We have a lot of rules that they are.
Like what?
Well, for one, like, there's no decoration, and I think that's just so wrong, because you're living here and you want to be comfortable where you're staying at and you want to feel good. They won't let us put any decorations outside. All we're going to do is put decorations on the inside, and I'm trying to think of some more stuff. It's a long list of rules and regulations.
Can you go out and in when you want?
To the best of my knowledge, yes. I didn't hear him say anything about that.
And how old's your baby?
She's 5. Uh-huh.
Does she go to some kindergarten or?
Yes. She goes to Baker Heights.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And how long do you plan to stay?
Oh, well, I'm planning on staying. I don't want to go back to New Orleans.
Why?
Because I don't think they're going to fix that levee. I don't think I'll be able to withstand. Mm-mm. And then hurricane season is coming again. I just don't trust it.
Do you have a phone that you can communicate here?
Yes, I have a cell phone.
How'd they give it to you?
FEMA, you have to go and apply. And then it's like after they give you free 300 minutes, and then after that, then you have to pay for it.
And do you have a landline inside your trailer for a land phone?
No. And that's the thing. We don't have cable. You can't have cable. You can't have regular telephone. It's nothing to do out here. That's why children are getting in trouble. It's nothing to do. They're trying to get some programs started, but it's kind of, they got some going on, but it's not enough.
That was Don Aziz speaking to us in Renaissance Village in Baker, Louisiana. As we traveled around, the security guards told us that we had to leave. These were security guards from CSS of Grand Rapids, Michigan, hired by FEMA. That's Corporate Security Solutions. These were guards, a number of whom had been in Afghanistan and Iraq. The residents, though, of Renaissance Village seemed surprised that they weren't allowed to speak in their own community. And one man asked if he could talk to us, and this is what happened.
Deception, lies, a famine, a shortage.
Wait, don't stop.
Everything. And it ain't no good to be here.
We were going in the car, and he said, yeah, please interview me.
He can't.
He's not allowed to talk? Privilege.
What's wrong?
You can go get that. You've known the deal since.
No, I don't know the deal. Tell me.
Get interviewed as long as it's off post. Otherwise,
you
like
mean
I
he
said,
has
I
to come off of the property
number and have them come?
What is a problem being interviewed?
Turn it off.
Turn it off, man. Won't have no problem.
Okay.
Because I don't know anything about okay. not be interviewed.
People, you know, you can be interviewed as long as it's off the installation.
Well, okay, we can move over there.
Other than that, that way it's fine.
Okay, we can move over there. Because I was sitting there reading my Bible, but I didn't know anything about will not
yes.
be interviewed.
No, you can be interviewed
okay.
if they had the FEMA representative with them, but since they don't and do not have an appointment.
Oh, okay, because I know they do it all the time.
Yes,
the
they have the FEMA public relations officer
well,
with them.
Okay, well, I didn't know.
I'm not mad at you, Red. You know that.
As we drove off of Renaissance Village, we were chased by the guards in golf carts who said that they would be taking down our license plate and that we couldn't return. This was the day after FEMA had ended the free meals that they had been providing to the more than 1,000 people, anyone who wanted to take advantage of it in Renaissance Village, again, about an hour away from New Orleans in Baker, Louisiana. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 420 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations, NPR stations, on low-power FM college and community radio stations, as well as public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. We're also video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, by this evening, the president of the Transport Workers Union Local 100, Roger Toussaint, will be in jail, serving a 10-day sentence in a lockup in Lower Manhattan known as the Tombs. Toussaint was sentenced to jail earlier this month by Judge Theodore Jones of the Brooklyn Supreme Court for authorizing a strike that shut down New York City's transit system for a little more than 2 days. The strike took place in December, just before Christmas, and violated the state's Taylor Law, which forbids public employees from striking. Toussaint and union supporters maintained that the strike was a defensive action to stop the Metropolitan Transportation Authority from, among other things, creating a two-tiered pension system. Toussaint was the only union member ordered to jail, even though lawyers for the MTA and the state attorney general said they wanted community service for union officials as opposed to jail time. and in further punishment for the strike, last week, Judge Jones fined the 33,000-member union $2.5 million and suspended its ability to automatically collect membership dues for 90 days.
In addition, last week, transit workers overwhelmingly ratified the contract offer they'd previously rejected. The package entails a 10.9% increase in raises and a new paid holiday. It also requires workers put 1.5% of their earnings towards health premiums. MTA head Peter Calico has stated the agency is not legally bound by the second vote, and the matter will go to binding arbitration. Roger Toussaint was elected head of the TWU Local 100 in 2000. He's originally from Trinidad and Tobago, settling in Brooklyn when he was 18. Hired by the MTA as a cleaner in 1984 and became a track worker in 85 and 94. He became a formal union member when he was elected leader of the 1,800-member track division. In 2000, elected president of the TWU. Roger Toussaint joins us here in our studio. In just a few hours, he'll be headed back to our area to turn himself in at the Tombs. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Roger Toussaint.
Morning.
Can you talk about why you're headed to jail today?
Why? Well, that was up to the judge. But essentially, they're trying to send a message that to the entire labor movement and all the social justice causes, that if you stand up and fight, they're going to crush you. So it's important that we send back a message to them. That's why they're subjecting us to what is the equivalent of a public flogging. The fines, the dues check-off elimination, as well as the jail, is truly excessive. It makes no sense other than to send a message.
Now, Roger, your members, after the strike ended and had a vote where they rejected the contract by just seven votes, and then subsequently you had a revote recently where it was overwhelmingly approved. Why do you think there was such a shift in the among the membership in terms of their views of the contract?
I think that there were two issues. One is that there was a misunderstanding of the provisions of the contract, particularly the contribution for a new benefit, which is retiree medical coverage. People misunderstood that as a contribution for existing coverage rather than new coverage. The second thing is that people misunderstood it as tripling over each year of the contract.
In other words, that it would go from 1.5 to 4.5 at the end of the three years.
And that was put out there by our opponents within the union who were working with the media, with the Post and the MTA, in my opinion. So those provisions were clarified, and that helped turn the vote around. Secondly, there's the question of binding arbitration. all members understand that in binding arbitration, we can end up losing job titles, job descriptions, and so forth. So those were the two factors that turned the vote around.
You're under enormous pressure right now. The union has been fined $2.5 million. The automatic dues checkoff, losing it, is a crisis for you.
Yes, right.
What are you doing? And explain what automatic dues checkoff is.
The employer takes dues out of each member's paychecks and forwards it to the union. That is a provision under state law that's called automatic dues checkoff. It's renewed every 2 years by the government and is intended to control unions. So one of the provisions of the Taylor Law is that if you're found guilty or violating the Taylor Law, you can lose dues checkoff. So they're taking it away from us.
And the Taylor Law, for those who are of our viewers and listeners not from New York State, is the state law that prohibits public employees from striking.
Strikes, job actions, slowdowns, sick outs, any type of what is called concerted activity, group activity.
So what will you do? $2.5 million is the fine.
Well, we're in the process of setting up a separate infrastructure to collect dues online, by checks, by four or five different methods for people to contribute.
Mm-hmm. And dealing with the fine?
Well, the fines will probably end up arranging to pay off over a schedule of payments over 6 months or 8 months.
What was astounding to me was that the judge's sentence on the dues checkoff was for an indefinite period, but you could come back after 90 days. So it wasn't like a determinate sentence. It was, if you behave yourselves,
exactly,
you may get your dues checkoff back. If you don't, I may continue to extend it further. Is that?
Exactly. The word is that they want us to proclaim publicly that we will not go back out on strike, and that will never happen.
Roger Toussaint, you've been reading Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail.
Yeah. That's according to the New York Post.
Right. Well, various reports. Is it true?
No, I mean, I've been doing lots of reading, but...
How are you preparing yourself for jail?
No, I'm doing mostly meetings with my officers and staff. I'll think about jail when I get there.
Well, luckily, I understand that the head of the Corrections Officers Association has said that he doesn't believe you're a criminal and that the correction officers will make sure that you're treated well while you're in jail. So that may upset the judge's plans a little bit. But I'd like to ask you, in terms of the impact of the strike and why, because I think this is critical to understand. This strike really sent shockwaves throughout the business establishment of New York City, and I think across the country. And your sense of what is the message that is being sent to the labor movement, and how other union officials and union organizations should respond.
Well, I think that we are at a defining moment in America. Pensions, health benefits are under attack from coast to coast. And the powers that be need there to be no resistance, no fight back. We made a decision back in December that we were not going to allow them to impose a new pension on future transit workers. same thing with health benefits. Union rights with respect to gains won over the past decades, work rules, job descriptions, and so forth, are also under attack. So in taking our stand in December, what we were saying is that that there needs to be a fight back. We too need to weigh in on defining and shaping the future of this country and this society. So that's the overall issue, I think. And we'll do it again, meaning that we are proud of the stand that we took back in December, and we understand the consequences, and we understand the magnitude and the enormity of the challenge that we are faced with. But there needs to be a fight back, and I think most working people understand what we are saying and what we are doing. And hopefully it helps to encourage more of a fight back. And there will be a lot more sacrifices will be called upon before we turn this whole situation around.
And to those critics who say that you did launch the fight back but then went back too soon, and that the union could have gotten a better deal had it stayed out longer, what's your response to that?
Well, armies that outstay, they're welcome on the battlefield, can get wiped out. Strikes are not about games and playing games with people's lives. You got to get in and out as soon as possible. We actually accomplished what we wanted, meaning to get the pension, the new pension deal off the table.
The two-tier
pension. And we were able to get items that were not available prior to the strike, such as retiree medical coverage, and in fact a pension refund worth $131 million to our members. Once we got those things, it was important and necessary to then exit the scene.
We're talking to Roger Toussaint, president of the Transport Workers Union Local 100, elected president in 2000, going to jail today for 10 days for leading a strike in December. We'll be back with him in a minute.
Now I'm a union man.
amazed at what I am. I say what I think, that the company stinks. Yes, I'm a union man. When we meet in the local hall, I'll be voting with them all. With a hell of a shout, it's out, brothers, out. And the rise of the factories fall.
Oh, you don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me, I'm part of the union. Till the day I die. Till the day I die.
As a union man, I'm wise to the lies of the company spies. And I don't get fooled by the factory rules, 'cause I always read between the lines. And I always get my way if I strike for higher pay. When I show my card to the Scotland Yard, and this is what I say.
The Straubs here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Roger Toussaint, president of the Transport Workers Union Local 100, elected president in 2000, led a major strike in New York in December. Now his union has been fined $2.5 million. The union, though, has overwhelmingly approved the contract. They've lost their automatic checkoff for dues, and Roger Toussaint heads to jail today for 10 days. You follow in the footsteps of a major union leader who led your union, Mike Quill, who also went to jail. Do you see similarities?
I would not flatter myself to put myself in the same times or in the same shoes. I stand on the shoulders of many.
Do you see the circumstances as being similar?
Coming out of a strike, yes.
And what do you say to those who say it was an illegal strike? You're not allowed to strike.
Most of us would not be here if unjust laws were not broken and challenged.
Well, I think the important issue of the climate in which your strike was conducted at a time when the labor movement is generally considered to be in retreat, and of course with a Republican president, a Republican Congress, a Republican governor of New York, and a Republican mayor of New York City, a lot of other labor leaders thought that you were partly suicidal even to actually go out on strike. I know privately, while some supported you privately, they were saying the TWU's got to be crazy. They're not going to be able to get out of this hole. Your sense of that?
We prevail. Keep in mind that the Democrats are not much better. But we'll prevail and we'll come out stronger as a union, both with respect to how we organize, how we deal with our membership. Because the pressure to collect dues individually and not rely on the employer is going to force us to change how we organize and how we deal with our membership. And that will be for the better.
When you say the Democrats are not much better, explain.
Well, I think that there were opportunities in the past decade or more to deal with the healthcare problem that the Democrats had available to them, and they fell down on that issue. The consequences that at every single labor negotiations, protecting health benefits has been the biggest issue, and people have had to trade work rules, past gains in order to hold on to their health benefits. So that's what I'm thinking of.
I wanted to go to the speech you gave. It was actually the news conference. It was Wednesday, December 21st. This is Roger Toussaint.
And this was after Governor Pataki had accused him of being criminals, I think, that the TWU strikers.
That's right. This is Roger Toussaint, president of the TWU.
All New Yorkers, I'd like to apologize for the inconvenience and beg our riders and all working people for their patience and forbearance for the inconvenience caused by our strike. a strike that we maintain that we were provoked into conducting. I just came from a meeting with state mediators, and I'll be leaving from here to resume discussions with state mediators sent in from Albany to attempt to assist both parties in the to get out of the current stalemate in the negotiations. Let me be very clear that we believe that the pension demands put forward by the MTA are illegal. To impose this on the negotiations is illegal and burdens the negotiations and should come off the table. We believe that if the pension demands that are illegal and a burden to the negotiations come off the table, that would go a long way to us resuming the negotiations and resolving the strike issue. The main holdup has been and is the pension issues. Let me explain that while you may discuss pensions in the course of negotiations, contract negotiations, it is clearly and plainly illegal for any side to impose a pension demand as a condition for a contract settlement. That is what the MTA did. On Thursday night, they submitted a final offer that included the creation of a new pension tier. That is illegal to submit as a final demand or final offer. I want to also address some of the remarks that have been made characterizing our members and our leadership in the course of these negotiations by the governor and the mayor. There's been some offensive and insulting language used, such as referring to our union members and our leadership as thugs, selfish, and essentially characterizing us as being overpaid and greedy. And this is regrettable, and it is certainly unbecoming for the mayor of the city of New York to be using this type of language to the people that in New York City entrust the care of over 7 million riders every single day. And maybe it is very difficult for a billionaire to understand what someone who's making a few tens of thousands of dollars are going through and meeting those bills and paying to put your children through school. Maybe there's that type of disconnect. But we believe that working people in New York can more better identify with transit workers and know instinctively that the thugs are not on this side of the podium. We are not thugs. We are not selfish. We are not greedy. We are hard-working New Yorkers, dignified men and women who have put in decades of service to keep the city moving 24/7. We wake up 3 and 4 in the morning to move trains and buses in this town, and we will continue to do that. And that's not the behavior of thugs and selfish people. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Roger Toussaint. He is president of the Transport Workers Union, December 21st, in the midst of the strike press conference in New York. Now he's with us in our Firehouse studio. We're downtown New York City, just yards from the place that Roger Toussaint will be turning himself in today, later in the day, for a 10-day sentence. But he will be coming over the Brooklyn Bridge just before he does this, with what's expected to be thousands of people, including union leaders. Can you talk about that final walk before jail?
Well, the only reason why we are marching is because they changed the venue for me to turn myself in. Originally, it was supposed to be Brooklyn, and they called us on Thursday and told us it's got to be Manhattan. That was meddling to try to mess up our plans. So that's the reason why we decided to march over the bridge. So we'll turn it against them. We expect that there'll be labor leaders out there. all of the unions that have been left without contracts for the past few years will be out there. Transit workers, of course, community leaders, and so on. So instead of this whole episode being an act of intimidation, it ought to be to encourage greater resistance and resolve. And in that respect, it will be turned around.
Your brother is the scholar Arnold Ramprasad at Stanford University, wrote the biography of Langston Hughes. And he was quoted as saying, talking about you, He could have been a scholar, too, but he decided to do something useful with his life. Although he's younger than me, he's someone I've always admired because of his temperament, seriousness, and commitment to social causes. You come from quite a family. Can you talk about what gives you this resolve? You were born in Trinidad?
Yeah, I mean, but primarily, I mean, I came up in a generation of young people in Trinidad that were shaped by the 1970 rebellion there. In the 1970 rebellion, as much as one-tenth of the population were involved in protests. The army mutinied in support of the demonstrators. How I came up wasn't unique for a young person in Trinidad. All of my whole generation was shaped by those events. Several people were killed. And all of the leaders were jailed, both military leaders as well as students and labor and so forth. So much of how I look at the world came from that experience in 1970. And then after that, I came up here and participated in the student protest in the mid-70s in New York.
And if you were to, say, look at the labor movement as you see it now in the United States, if there was one thing that the labor movement could begin to do to turn around the situation that it finds itself in today, what's your estimate of what would need it to be done?
Well, I think that you got to find an issue or cause and rally around. And it could be any number of things. The fight that our union is now conducting is one possibility, to rally around that cause, to rally around us both with respect to the show of solidarity today as well as with respect to the money that we need to pay those fines. That would be one way to send a message. Something else that I would like to see done is to shut down the New York Post, as an example. Some way to display the strength and solidarity and the unity of both labor and the communities in order to build up a fight-back movement. So you can pick any number of different issues or causes, but there are numbers that are available out there. Unfortunately,
why do you say shut down the New York Post?
Well, the New York Post, it could be the Daily News as well. My point is labor and the communities need to show the strength and power of protest and solidarity. And in doing so, you need to target the opponents of working people. And the New York Post is just an extortionist media. And that would be a good way to send a message out there.
And as you head to jail right now for 10 days, you're speaking to a national, actually international audience as we broadcast around the world. What do you think is the most critical message to put out right now?
There's a right-wing agenda over there to shut down pensions, health benefits, Medicare, Social Security. To reverse work rules that have been established over decades. We desperately need a fight-back movement. And we need a whole new generation of sacrifice and struggle and protest. So if what we have been going through contributes to that, then so be it. We need to see more rigorous challenges and protests taking place.
Do you feel like you have the support of the leadership of the AFL-CIO?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. But more importantly, I think that the most working people understand what's going on.
Roger Toussaint, I want to thank you very much for being with us. I hope you'll give us a call from jail, and we'll let people know how you're doing over these next 10 days.
Sure.
Roger Toussaint, president of the Transport Workers Union Local 100, goes to jail later today. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shroof Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Frank Lopez, Jenny Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio, our engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Strenberg-Peshkin, Megan Whitney. Our website is democracynow.org. You can get our transcript, we video and audio podcast there. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!